This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. There's a lot of money floating around in politics. The effects of it are seen in television ads and flyers. And while a lot of money is spent on the presidential race, some down-ballot candidates have well-funded supporters too, and glossy flyers are piling up in those races as well. So is it money well spent? Is a mailer targeting the state attorney or congressional candidate in your district going to sway your opinion if you're already feeling bombarded with presidential politics? Are you looking beyond the headlines on those mailers to who's paying for the ads? Later in the show, we'll talk about the down-ballot races, like who's running for judge. How do you go beyond the yard signs to figure out who to put the check mark next to in the voting booth? And as Florida's demographics change, the candidates are reaching out to new voters, especially the Latino community. What are you hearing from the candidates that'll get you out to the voting booth on August 30th and in 2.5 months from now? We're at 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. Well, joining me in the studio, Frank Torres, Orlando Political Observer. Welcome back, Frank.
Good morning.
Also joined by Stephen Limangelo. He's the political reporter for the Orlando Sentinel. Thank you so much for joining us, Steve.
No problem. Good morning.
And joining us from Tallahassee, Tramell Gomes. He is host of the Rotunda podcast. Nice to have you back, Tramell.
Thanks for having me, Matthew.
You can join us too. We're at 1-866-338-5252. Taking a look at some of the money that's floating around in these down ballot races. Now, Orange and Osceola County State Attorney Jeff Ashton is running for re-election. In the primary at the end of this month, he's up against Aramis Ayala, former assistant state attorney in his own circuit. Ashton may have the advantage of the incumbency, but in the last couple of weeks, voters will have seen flyers attacking Ashton and boosting Ayala stuffed into their mailboxes. Those flyers are paid for by the Florida Safety and Justice Political Action Committee to the tune of about $444,000. Frank Torres, let me start with you. First of all, is this race a $500,000 race? It seems like a lot of money to be dumping into a state attorney campaign.
You know, you wouldn't think about it when you first hear, you know, state attorney race or state attorney campaign, but this race is turning into an expensive affair, and it's a really important job when you think about it, and involves, you know, the one of the most powerful professions in Central Florida. To see this money sort of flow into this, and to see this intense race between Jeff Ashton, who's been involved in controversy over the last, you know, basically 5 years, if you include the Casey Anthony trial, and his challenger Aramis Ayala, who's been running a lot of heavy media. It's turned into a real high-profile race, but for the second time since 2012, it's a good thing because this is also a really important high-profile position.
What about this notion of outside money? In this case, it's from a George Soros-funded political action committee. I mean, is that something that can come back and hurt a candidate?
You know, it's kind of how it depends on how each side plays the angle of the outside money. You've heard Jeff Ashton through a press conference last week saying that outside parties were trying to influence a race that was very important to Central Florida. And that's an angle you'll hear played not only in state attorney races, but in congressional races and municipal races. How much power should outside parties have in determining the outcome of local races? So that's a tone you've heard him play, and that's something that Aramis Ayala has also had to answer a lot of questions about.
Yeah, he's saying something like his office is, quote, not for sale.
Right, and that's something, and you'll hear that in other races. This congressional seat is not for sale. This House seat is not for sale. It's something we hear a lot in politics when it comes to outside money interfering in local races, which is something we're seeing more and more through each election cycle.
It should be noted, too, that this is not Aramis Ayala kind of calling for the money. She said, "Well, I wasn't asking for this, but I'll take it. I'll gratefully accept the advertisements."
Yeah, you know, if the money's there, this is a business that still revolves around money. You know, it's second to only votes, and if these resources come in, you're not going to see very many candidates turn it away.
Tramell Gomes, let me bring you in on this conversation. What's your sense of kind of how much money overall has been funneled into state and local election campaigns now? Are we seeing just the amounts are ramping up time and time again?
It's continuing to increase, and even especially on the local level, because we're seeing it's a bigger bang for your buck when these corporations and organizations decide to invest their funds locally. That $1,000 that they would have spent in a federal race goes a lot further in a local race. Mm-hmm. So it's growing, and we've seen efforts to try and stop and take money out of politics, but at this rate, it's not slowing down.
Is there a point at which you think, Trammell, voters might hit saturation point? There's no more value in spending more money, or do you get the sense we're just going to see campaign spending just keep climbing and climbing as we head into future elections?
Voters are interested in seeing reform. Here in Tallahassee, they voted to put forward an ethics chairperson to actually pull back and look at how campaign financing works. And they want to see transparency. You put that issue on the ballot, they on both sides, whichever party affiliation, they're voting for it. But the system is the way it is now, and it's just feeding itself. And the media, this is the time that everyone's making a lot of money, because all of those millions of dollars are being spent on these TV stations, radio stations, and newspaper ads digitally. So the cycle continues to grow, and it's the snowball effect, and it's not slowing down.
Mm-hmm. Stephen Limoncello, let me bring you in on the conversation. So, you know, we're seeing flyers. Some of them are pretty glossy. They're quite large. They've got some interesting facts, sometimes disputed by mm-hmm. the people they're targeting. But it's a kind of an old school way of reaching voters. Does this kind of marketing still work?
Oh, it seems to. For example, like the, you know, locally, like the Winter Park race last year, there was a huge amount of, like, you know, flyers coming in, paid for by the county Republican Party, state Republican Party, just, mm-hmm. you know, tying it was, and that's a nonpartisan race, too. But like, there was a Republican, there was a Democrat. And of course, they targeted the Democrat. They said that how she gave like $1,000 to the Obama campaign. She donated to the Val Demings campaign. And that, you know, that caused a lot of, you know, friction among, like, you know, her Republican supporters, who are like, this is supposed to be a nonpartisan race. Why is the Republican Party getting it? But they were essentially, you know, the city was flooded with these things. Like, she didn't really have a response in her direction, and it worked. It seems to work.
Mm-hmm. What about the fine print? I mean, do you get the sense that voters will flip the flyer over, look at who's paying for the flyers, and kind of follow the money, or even the TV ads? Are they going to stick around to the end of it and say, Who's paying for this, and sort of connect those dots?
Well, sure. A lot of times, you know, the PACs and groups that do this have these sort of vague, sort of, you know, like, you know, X for this and X for that. That, you know, no one, if you don't know who these people are, and if, you know, actually check in Google and say who are these people, then you'll never know. I mean, I'll say, like, for example, the Winter Park race last year that I was just talking about, mm-hmm. that actually was, you know, paid for by the Republicans. And that did cause a lot of controversy among, you know, say, a lot of Republican women supporting the challenger, who said, you know, this is supposed to be a nonpartisan race. And a lot of them, you know, went in and changed their registrations to independent. But a lot of that's just sort of overtly, you know, stuff paid for by the, you know, parties, local parties and groups. Mm-hmm. Other things, PACs and things like that, PACs have this such vague and, you know, nondescriptive names that if you don't actually go and try to find out who these people are, you pretty much won't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, safety and justice. I mean, who can argue with that, right?
Oh, yeah.
We're at 1-866-338-5252. What kind of flyers are you seeing in your mailbox? What do you do with them? Do you chuck them out, or do you read them and sort of take time to think about what they're saying? The Sentinel also reported this week on the campaign spending of political corporate political action committees, like the Publix, SeaWorld, Harris Corporation, Tupperware. According to the article, they've spent more than $2 million on candidates in this election cycle, not on presidential candidates, but on those running for Congress. Steve, what does this tell you about this election, that PAC money from corporations is being spent to support congressional candidates, you know, rather than, say, a presidential candidate?
Well, sure. Besides the fact of, you know, where the Trump campaign is, there's the sort of the conversation among the Republicans. Do we really worry about that, or just worry about the down ballot? The fact is that this year for congressional races especially, it's very unique in that there's a lot of competitive congressional races. Usually there's like maybe one here that's sort of competitive, like a lot of, you know, incumbents and things like that. But here mm-hmm. you have open seat in 10. You have an open seat in 9. 7 is because of the changes made to that district. You know, it's 50-50 now, Democrats, Republicans, and the Democrats seem to feel they have a sort of a chance, at least, against Micah.
Right.
And that's the thing. Like, you know, these sort of situations come up very rarely. Once these people are elected, they'll become the incumbents, and they might be there forever. So if you really want to, you know, make a difference or affect an election, this is a good time for you.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you get feedback from your readers? Do they kind of give you an idea of what they feel about campaign spending by political action committees? I mean, are people getting used to Citizens United, or is it still controversial?
Essentially, we don't hear too much from that. We hear the sort of same sort of, like, generic, oh, we need to get the money out of politics, like that sort of thing. But in terms of details about PACs and Citizens United, not really so much. It's just sort of like a general sense of, you know, there's money coming in from somewhere, from, you know, quote unquote Wall Street, you know, a special interest, that sort of thing. As to, you know, at the same time, they might be getting, you know, flyers and things from various PACs, and it might affect them. And they at the same time, they rail against, you know, where the money's coming from.
Frank Torres, the Sentinel story points out an upward trend in campaign spending by corporate PACs, but there's also an interesting note in here. Darden, a big Central Florida company, shut down its political action committee. What does that suggest? I mean, does that suggest that, you know, maybe this committee spending isn't as worthwhile as you might think?
It could say that, but on the other hand, Darden's had a really tough couple of years. There's been a lot of layoffs at the corporate levels, controversies involving their brands. So I think that could be tied to some financial problems with the company as well. But, you know, different companies will go different directions. And if they don't feel that they're getting their money's worth, then they could perhaps encourage the individuals within the organization to support other organizations which have common interests as they do. You know, it's not Darden will have its own PAC, but there's also other different hospitality PACs and PACs tied to restaurants and tourism and lodging. So there's plenty of other outlets for them to sort of coalition build and make sure that money is getting out to support their causes. So I think it's kind of a combination of the two, some personal history involving the company and the recent trends in its business, as well as, you know, perhaps exploring other outlets to spend their money politically.
So people start buying more breadsticks, we could see the pack return.
If the breadstick sandwiches and a soup and salad all pays off and, you know, things turn around, that pack could very well return.
Tramell Gomes, if it's not through a political action committee, you know, how else are companies able to sort of mold the political landscape in their favor?
Well, there are several ways. Where there's an opportunity to inject influence, they will take advantage of it. Some of the things that people should look out for are what are called, like, you know, 527s, similar to the tax codes, where they operate sort of like a PAC, but they accept unlimited contributions from anyone, and they influence elections. The other thing to look out for is what it's sort of called, like, dark money, where you have these organizations, nonprofits, where they're allowed to contribute to a campaign. They have a certain threshold, but you're seeing these organizations with you know, very friendly sounding names, great causes and stuff like that, and they're buying campaign ads and stuff like that. So there are ways to work around the system, and what we're seeing is, like, with these PACs and these 527s and these dark money, they're taking advantage of getting around the system of just, like, you know, if there's a limit on campaign contribution, they can use these organizations to go beyond those caps.
So 527 is like a non-profit? What is it?
527, these are advocacy groups, and they're usually tied to, like, you know, wealthy individuals or corporations. And yes, they're groups, and they accept funds, and they put it towards campaigns.
If it's dark money, though, as you say, how easy is it for the average voter, if there is such a thing, to kind of keep abreast of all this and keep tabs on it?
Well, usually their names and the dark money ones, they're surrounded around the 501c4 code. And you see, as we're getting deeper into the weeds here, but over at the top, they have, I'm trying to think of a name, but just think of any positive sounding organization or something for ethics and fairness, a group called something like that. And you would find that, you know, they're buying ads and they're funneling it towards a particular campaign, individual. And it's hard to really go back and track these as we're seeing the proliferation and it continues to grow. And there's so many PACs and organizations. And as we go through, there's so many to choose from. So it's really hard on the individual and the average citizens to really sit back unless they really have an interest and they're studying this or something.
Right, some time up their sleeve. Frank Torres, I see you nodding your head there talking about some of these friendly sounding names.
Yeah, they're friendly sounding names. It's almost like, you know, puppies and kittens for Jim Smith for House. You know, these things are really, really useful. You can, you know, route as much money. You can exceed campaign donor limits. If an individual reaches their limit on your normal individual account, they can go to these extra PACs and donate even more money. And, you know, and they're meant to sound friendly. So when the common voter reads, you know, these you know, very friendly sounding names on these mailers, they tie to the candidate and sort of, you know, mm-hmm. sort of put the tie everything together and have an overall favorable image of the person running for office that they see on the mailer. So, yeah, it's these PACs, and they're not just for the big races. We've seen them on local races as well. They're just such a useful tool for candidates that they show no sign of going away.
Puppies and kittens. Who can say no to a puppy or
exactly.
a kitten? You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. Still to come, Florida's demographics are changing. The gap between registered Republicans and Democrats in the state is narrowing too. But candidates are trying to get new voters, courting the Latino vote in particular. Also, the primary's coming up fast. Are you a quote-unquote super voter who makes the effort to get out and vote in the primary? So we scroll down ballot towards the judges' races and others. And later in the show, is LG bogging down Governor Rick Scott and a Pulse-inspired political action committee launches. That's when Intersection returns in a minute.
Support for 90.7 News comes from Florida Hospital, presenting an evening with renowned surgeon and author Atul Gawande, Wednesday, September 21st. Dr. Gawande will discuss his latest book and ways medicine may improve the process of aging and death. The event is open to the public, but an RSVP is required for admission. Registration is available at floridahospitaldls.com.
Good morning, I'm Nicole Creston. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. You can take us with you anywhere you go throughout the day by downloading the WMFE mobile app. It's free for Apple and Android and all mobile devices. Just search WMFE in the App Store or Google Play Store.
Support for 90.7 News comes from News 13, Central Florida's only 24-hour local news channel, providing bus stop forecasts during Weather on the Ones on your morning news. News 13 is exclusively on Bright House Networks. News 13. News. Weather. Now.
Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. With me in the studio, Steve Limangelo from the Orlando Sentinel, Frank Torres with the Orlando Political Observer, and joining us by phone from his office in Tallahassee, Tramell Gomes, host of the Rotunda podcast. You can join us too. We're at 1-866-338-5252, talking about the demographic change in Florida's electorate, how candidates are working to woo new voters. What do you want to hear from those candidates? Also, in the deluge of information about the presidential election, you might overlook some of the other races up for grabs. Those races at the top of the ticket are dominating the airwaves, but are voters starting to see more flyers and ads on the down ballot races? The answer, of course, is yes. How do you make informed choices about those races? How do you get beyond those ballots, those flyers and those other ads you might be seeing? Well, let's start with the judicial races way down the bottom there. In Orange County, for example, there are 14 people running in four districts. Four of those judges are running unopposed. Now, this primary is coming up. It's less than 2 weeks away. Frank Torres, the judges up for election are trial judges. Now, the races are nonpartisan. What else should voters be aware of heading into the voting booth?
You know, the voters really have to do their research on these judicial races because they're not media attractive races, but they're still very important. Now, judicial candidates are nonpartisan. They can't personally ask you for money. They can't answer hypothetical ruling questions like, how would you have ruled on Trayvon Martin? How would you have ruled on Casey Anthony? They can't answer any of those hypothetical questions. So it really comes down to philosophy. Mm-hmm. Questions like how they would run their courtroom. How would they deal with the limited resources that seem to get even more and more, they seem to get reduced every year inside the court system. It really is more of philosophies and logistics that make up the overall campaign platform of judicial candidates. And it's not always easy to find. Yeah, you can Google and you can read the website. But this is where hobnobs and these political events really come into play. A lot of people are attracted to the high-profile candidates, but you know they really need to do their research. And if they get a chance to meet these candidates for judges, just sort of ask them a lot of questions because you know it's just you never know how important these races are until these judges actually get in office and they're making headlines, not because of their campaigns, but because of some of their rulings.
So, I mean, it sounds like unless you are working in the criminal justice system, you're a lawyer perhaps, I mean, hopefully you're never going to have to come across a judge unless it's in a social occasion.
Right.
You do need a little bit of specialized knowledge.
Yeah, you do need a bit of specialized knowledge, and it's not always easier to find. The media industry is always, as they continue to make cuts, they can't cover as many races as they used to. The Orlando Sentinel used to have these awesome interviews that used to, and they used to be the only real outlet for for information on judicial candidates. But I believe there have been even some reductions in that area as well. So, you know, you really have to go out there and do your research, sort of look at their websites, and also look at any media coverage that they might have been able to garner. But they're very important races that not enough people pay enough attention to.
Okay, so you've got political hobnobs, places where, you know, opportunities where you can actually go and hear these potential judges talking and kind of get an impression from that. But what other information is out there so voters can make up their minds? You know, it's not like a lawmaker for running for re-election. As you said, you can't look up a voting record or other issues.
You know, aside from hobnobs and, you know, events where we might be able to meet these judicial candidates, it's kind of tough to find, which makes it even more of a challenge for voters that just get frustrated and often will undervote and leave the race empty, or just, you know, go with their gut on certain races, which is an unfortunate way to vote, but something that's done. A lot of people just don't have time to research these judicial races. I think if they get a chance to get a preview, get a early look at their ballot and really sort of look at everybody who's running, you know, take an extra couple of minutes to, you know, to do their research on these judges and find everything they can on them. And I think they'll be surprised at some of the information they'll find. You know, mm-hmm. We often think judicial candidates are perfect, but some of them, I'll never forget those interviews that were done. The first questions they're asked is, have they ever been arrested? Have they ever, you know, had a bankruptcy? And mm-hmm. some of them have. And, you know, it really does sort of change the optics on these judicial races.
Mm-hmm. Judges are people too.
Absolutely. Judges are people too. So
we're at 1-866-338-5252. How much attention are you paying to these down-ballot races? Do you rely on the flyers you're getting, or are you taking a closer look and trying to find out some more information on these other races? Frank Torres, you know, obviously these races are nonpartisan, but what are the rules do candidates have to follow?
Well, you know, they can't personally ask you for money. They're often represented by committees running for office. No hypothetical rulings. And, you know, there are just a bunch of these rules, these things that you don't see in other races that the judicial candidates have to abide by. And if you're talking to these candidates and you ask them a question, and they sort of back up or recoil from answering you, it's normally not because they don't know the answer or they're afraid of the question. It's just that they're simply not allowed to. So that makes some real awkward conversations I've seen play out in these races. When a voter asks, well, what do you think of the George Zimmerman trial?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I can't really, you know, comment on how, you know, I would have ruled on that. Well, what do you mean you can't comment on that? It was one of the biggest cases in Central Florida the past couple of years. Things like that is what really sort of makes these, you know, these races different from other contests on the ballot.
Right. Tramiel, way back in 2000, there was a ballot initiative for merit selection and retention of trial judges. This was sponsored by the Bar Association. Supporters had raised the issue of campaign contributions tarnishing the judiciary. The measure failed. Voters didn't go for it. But I'm wondering what you're hearing. I mean, is the idea of doing away with judicial elections something you still hear rumblings about in Tallahassee?
You know, surprisingly, it has not been talked about since the heyday and the effort being pushed for it back in 2012. And I'll continue on that. But back to what you were talking about with Frank regarding raising awareness about these judicial races and stuff like that. The Tallahassee Bar Association did something interesting where they polled their members regarding the two candidates running in the second judicial here and pushed out a press release showing, asking all these questions about, like, you know, the judges' temperament and all of their fairness and how they've worked in the mm-hmm. courtroom and between the two candidates, and there was a winner between the two. So that was one way of something interesting that I thought of that was done here in Tallahassee by the local Bar Association that hopefully others, those similar associations, could do to shine some spotlight on those candidates. But with the merit retention, it's an issue that I think that needs attention, because when you're looking at these races and these judges, it's a very important role. And what we're seeing, these judges who are campaigning, these trial judges, they're getting supporters from mostly private law firms, the people that will be coming before their courtrooms. And can you imagine the one that gave all their effort and time and volunteering or a lot of campaign contributions, and when it's time to make a very important decision regarding that case, will the judge be fair, impartial, and not be subject to influence from all the help that he receives? So it's an issue that should get attention, but I haven't seen any official word from either the Bar Association, the Florida Bar Association, picking up that issue again.
Steve, let me just come back to this idea of how these races are run. And I'm wondering, do you see the same kind of expensive campaigning, mailers, television, radio spots, in judicial campaigns as you will in congressional and other races?
You are seeing a lot of it, especially, and of course, you know, we've all driven along, you know, various roads and see that it's just signs, you know, if there's like just a whole string of signs with a bunch of names you probably don't know, that's probably for the judicial races as well. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing, like, you know, a lot of people, the average voter, you know, even the average person who pays attention to politics probably doesn't know too much about, you know, who these people are. Like, for example, I went to I talked to the judicial reporter who covers these races for us, and when I was trying to fill out my ballot, I said, "Okay, who should I vote for here? Who are these people? Mm-hmm. Who do you recommend?" That sort of thing. It's just because it's you don't really think about it too often that there's this district, there's this group, and this is just okay. Who are all these people? So that's why things like mailers and things like that just help in just letting you know there actually is a race.
Right. Judicial races, as we said, are nonpartisan, but are these campaigns sometimes a stepping stone for other elected offices?
Oh, sure. A lot of these judges, end up running for state attorney at some point. Eventually, might go to like a higher thing in the state. So it does. These are sort of stepping stones. So these things do have, meaning beyond just, covering just, regular courtrooms and things like that.
Mm-hmm. So that's something to think about when you're putting that check mark on the ballot. The judge you're voting for now could be your state attorney at some point in the future.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. There's this big swath of judgeships up for grabs, as you point out. When you're driving along, you'll see a bunch of signs. A lot of these are for a judge, but primary turnout's quite low, right? So what's your sense of just how much attention voters are paying to these judicial races?
Not too much. The fact is, Florida is very strange. With most other states, they have, these sort of congressional, judge primaries. Places like March at the same time as the presidential primary, so you get the people are active and they're like, want to go out there and vote, but of course now it's Florida has theirs in like late August, literally the week before Labor Day. Mm-hmm. It's like it's August. How much attention is people really paying to these sort of things? I mean, you're lucky if they're paying attention to like the Senate and the congressional races, never mind like all the various down ballot races.
Right, Frank Torres.
A lot of times these judicial campaigns will use even the most primitive sort of means to get people to remember their names.
Right.
We have a Judge Tennis. What did she put on her campaign signs? A tennis ball. We have Judge Schott. What did he put on his campaign signs? A basketball net. Anything you can get to get these voters to remember your name, they'll put it on that sign. It's just, mm-hmm. It really is, that technique of getting people to remember you in these down the ballot races that can sort of resonate with voters and make sure that they check, they circle in your name on the ballot.
What about some of the other races then? Are you seeing those primitive techniques, as you say, for things like, sheriff, other elected officials?
Yeah, it almost becomes a matter of what kind of gimmick you're running on more than your actual platform. Oh, well, this is the interesting sign person, or this is the person who has this on their literature or says this, a catchphrase sometimes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, that's what it takes to get the voters' attention to make sure they remember you when they go to the polls.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to move on and talk about the demographic change in the electorate, how that's affecting how and where candidates are campaigning, where other interest groups are focusing their attention to. Steve, let me start with you. The Sentinel reported this week about the shift in the demographics of registered Democrats in Florida. What did you find?
Well, sure. We took a look at the latest numbers closing July 31st for the state, and we found that for the first time, essentially, the registrations for the Democratic Party in Florida were whites were the minority there. It was just a little bit. It's like whites are now 49.9 something. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty much and that's new. Pretty much most other states don't count like race and ethnicity when, garnering up, voter numbers. So it may be the case that I think it's the case already in North Carolina. The Democratic Party is majority minority. It's probably the case elsewhere in places like Hawaii and California. But Florida is the largest state that counts that race and ethnicity data, and it's pretty much shows where the party is going right now, where the state is going. We looked at new registrations since January for Hispanics, for example. We made a chart. It looks like Democratic registrations for Hispanics looks like it's a rocket taking off. Same thing with for nonpartisan, and that's just slightly less it still looks like, you know, a rocket going off. But then you look at the numbers for new Republican Hispanic registrations. It looks like a rocket that sort of takes off and is about to crash into the ocean, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
So
does it have a platform to land on? In the
we'll have to see if Musk can provide one for them. But essentially, since the beginning, 8 out of 10 new Hispanic registration has been for either Democrats or nonpartisan. And the Republican Party is getting more white all the time in this state. And people have said that's not good for where the country is going.
Mm-hmm. We're at 1-866-338-5252. Are you maybe one of those newly registered voters this year? And is the presidential election kind of what got you to register? And I'm wondering, Steve, is that why we're seeing this rocket taking off analogy in the registrations? Is it just because this is presidential politics?
Yeah. If you look at the actual numbers, like new registrations sort of peak in February and March before the presidential primary. Then they sort of dip for a little bit, and now they're starting to come up again, both with the presidential race coming up. And also, if you want to register as a Democrat or Republican, you have to do it before August 1st to vote in the August 30th primary. So between the those races and the presidential race, that seems to be the cause of the increase in registrations.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not only candidates and campaigns seeking out the Latino vote. The AFL-CIO, it's the largest group of labor unions in the United States, is also working on a Get Out the Vote campaign aimed at the Latino community. The AFL-CIO's executive vice president, Tafari Gabray, talked to 90.7. He says Florida's an important state for the labor movement.
Florida is rich because it is a very diverse state. From Puerto Ricans to Cubanos to everybody from Latin America comes to Florida and resides here in Florida. And they have specific issues that they want to talk about. And their issues are American issues. They want to have access to affordable health care. They want to have quality public schools that they can send their kids to. And also, they have cousins and neighbors that they don't want to be discriminated because of their immigration status.
So, Steve Limoncello, there's the executive vice president of the biggest union in the United States talking about how Latino voters' issues are American issues. But I'm wondering, I mean, just back to the point about this demographic shift in the Democratic Party, at least, I mean, do you get the sense that there are Latino-specific issues that are going to shape the Florida Democratic Party, its policy, for example, or is that just kind of a little too simplistic?
Oh, sure. Well, the huge influx in Puerto Rican voters, both from the island and from, you know, older Puerto Rican people moving down from New Jersey and New York, for example, has made the Puerto Rican economic issue a huge issue. That, most Democrats talk about it now. Immigration, simply in opposition to what, Donald Trump has been proposing and the Republicans have been proposing, has been big for Democrats. And as those numbers increase as the more and more Hispanics join the Democratic Party, and for a long time, like, Puerto Ricans, even still, like, more of the Puerto Ricans who live in Central Florida are nonpartisan than Democratic, but that's starting to be ticking up for the Democrats. So if mm-hmm. that's a group they want to go after, they need to touch on these issues.
Mm-hmm. Frank Torres, you were at a political hobnob for Hispanic voters or organized by the Hispanic community. I'm wondering, what was your sort of takeaway from that? Do you get the sense that this is an electorate, a group of voters that is being targeted more and more by not just the Democratic Party, but of course the Republicans as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Both parties are really targeting Hispanic voters because they could very well be the group that affects the race for the White House. You have a large Puerto Rican population in the center of one of the biggest battlegrounds in the country, here in the I-4 corridor, which stretches from Daytona Beach all the way to Tampa. A lot of that concentration is here in Orlando. So you saw representatives from both parties courting, I believe it was about over 400 Puerto Rican voters or Hispanic voters at this event. And, most of the issues discussed were opportunities for the growing population in the community and other platforms or other issues like education and jobs. And they all revolved around this growing population and what each party and each candidate can do to sort of, to earn their support in exchange for making sure that they have a platform that that can deliver on results. And I believe it was a kickoff for the kind of general election campaign we're going to see by both presidential candidates here over the next couple of months.
Tramiel Gomes, we've heard a lot about the plight of the Puerto Rican community, especially in Central Florida, because a lot of folks are leaving the island. They move to Central Florida. They have family here, and they try to make a new life here. But is that an issue? Is your sense that that's an issue that's going to gain more traction as the general election nears, or is this going to fade?
I think it will gain traction. Everyone is scrambling for potential voters, and the exodus and those who are relocating to Florida, particularly from Puerto Rico, that is a prime target. Every vote counts, and you're seeing the campaigns, particularly the Hillary campaign, making a big effort to try and court with their staffing and hiring of bilingual staffers to really target this demographic. So I think until election day is over, they're the prize, and the attention will be on them and many others. They're going to scrape up as much as they can get.
Mm-hmm. Well, still to come on Intersection, we're going to talk about Algie and Governor Rick Scott. We'll also talk about the Pulse nightclub shooting that inspired a political action committee this week. Is Pulse on your mind as you head to the ballot box next week? What about November? Intersection continues in a minute.
Support for 90.7 News comes from Rumberger, Kirk, and Caldwell. Trial attorneys meeting the litigation needs of the business community. Offices in Orlando, Tampa, Tallahassee, Miami, and Birmingham, Alabama. Learn more at Rumberger.com. Rumberger, Kirk, and Caldwell. Litigation. It comes naturally to us.
This is Intersection. Good morning. I'm Nicole Creston. In your forecast, mostly sunny skies today, hot and humid with afternoon highs reaching the low to mid 90s before a 30% chance of scattered afternoon showers and thunderstorms moves in. Overnight lows dropping into the upper 70s. Similar conditions for the weekend.
Support for 90.7 News comes from VoiceOnix, celebrating 10 years in the Central Florida community. Locally owned and operated, VoiceOnix provides business on-site installations of phone systems and service. Information on scheduling a phone system demonstration at your business or at their showroom in Orlando is available at voiceonix.com.
Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. Joining me in the studio, Steve Limangiello. He's the political reporter with the Orlando Sentinel. Also got Frank Torres, editor of the Orlando Political Observer. And with us by phone from Tallahassee, Tramell Gomes, host of the Rotunda podcast. You can join us too. We're at 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. Well, it's now 2 months since the mass shooting at the Pulse nightclub. One of the questions we had in the aftermath was whether it would spur something different in the debate over gun control that reignites after every mass shooting in the United States. Well, last Wednesday, the Pride Fund to End Gun Violence launched. Supporters of the Political Action Committee include the likes of outspoken Orlando City Commissioner Patty Sheehan. The PAC's aim is to, quote, elect candidates that will act on sensible gun policy reforms while championing LGBTQ safety and equality. End quote. Now, to that end, they want to expand background checks, stop suspected terrorists from buying guns, restrict access to assault rifles and high-capacity magazines, support federally funded gun violence research, and stop people convicted of hate crimes from buying guns. And they want to take on the NRA. Frank Torres, what about the timing here? Is it surprising to you that it took 2 months for a PAC like this to form?
Not really. I think it's just about on time. You know, they had to be sensitive to the matter and to the victims and family before they started to start this political action committee. And this is just that. It's a PAC. It's going to be used to move legislation and to affect races. I covered that rally, and a large takeaway from that was that a lot of the speakers at that event wanted to see Marco Rubio defeated in November. They believe that he capitalized off the Pulse shooting and sort of used it as a platform to jump into his reelection campaign. Most of the speakers on the program said that, but they're also going to try to oppose the NRA and try to move other issues along gun control that they feel matches their platform. But this is very much a PAC, and it's going to be used to swing things politically towards their views.
We're at 1-866-338-5252. How much is Pulse on your mind as you think about heading into the ballot box? Going to the voting booth, rather, next week and further ahead in November. Are these issues kind of weighing on your mind as you make those votes? 1-866-338-5252. Frank, do you get the sense there's more momentum now for some kind of meaningful gun reform than after previous mass shootings in the U.S.?
You know, on a state level, I still don't see the chains moving at the state level. There wasn't a special session. There isn't a hunger in the House, and not that much more hunger in the Senate for any sort of change. I think we're going to continue to see more pro-gun legislation like campus carry, mm-hmm. open carry. I think we're going to see those again. in Washington, you know, I think there just isn't much movement between Republicans and Democrats on this issue. And I think that's what aggravates a lot of people on both sides. I think the fact that there's just such a strong philosophical barrier on the topic that prevents any sort of change from happening. And at the same time, we continue to see a lot of these events occur. It's just a basic dispute of what causes these things. And until we can reach a agreement on that, we're not going to see much movement from the legislature on any level.
One interesting thing I thought to come out of that announcement, I was reading that Patty Sheehan said she has a handgun for self-protection. Now, when people sort of look at this debate from afar, I guess there's a tendency to see things in kind of black and white, right? But does this add some nuance to this idea of gun control? Does it seem like it might have a better chance of success where maybe others have failed?
You know, one thing you'll hear from a lot of the speakers at this program is, I have a gun and I don't want to take anybody's guns away. Even Democratic candidates involved in heated primaries, they're still sticking by the Second Amendment, but they're really sort of pushing on the assault weapons ban, reinstating that, and the basic belief over what justifies self-defense and what just justifies an assault weapon that's designed for killing. I think you're seeing a lot of disagreement on those fronts before the two crowds that are involved.
Mm-hmm. Tramiel Gomes, so far we've seen the likes of Darren Soto pick up the idea of expanded background checks, some of the other things that the likes of this political action committee is pushing for. Do you see some of those ideas gaining favor with GOP lawmakers and candidates as well?
As Frank mentioned, nope, it's not gaining any favor. And what we're actually going to see likely is the NRA, and they will not back down. And you'll see them push forward their proposals again and again and again, as they always do in the upcoming legislative session. So you're going to be seeing intermittent fights with those bills through the committee process here at the Capitol. And it will be up to these organizations and through the PACs and their influence, however they're going to try and sway, whether they're buying ads and stuff like that, to try and put pressure on the lawmakers that would most likely vote in favor of NRA-pushed measures.
Mm-hmm. Steve, I'm wondering, do you see this kind of gun debate having more of an impact on the direction on political campaigns at the state and local level, or do you think it's really got some traction at the national level?
It seems to be getting traction at the national level. You see, before previous gun incidents Sandy Hook, Aurora, Colorado, there seems to be there was a sort of movement in the few weeks afterwards, the months afterwards, and it sort of seemed to go away. And you see, even in the last decade, you had John Kerry, having to go out and say, I'm a hunter, and going out and shooting and stuff like that. The Democrats still felt they had to sort of play very safely with, gun control and gun safety. That seems to have, stopped now, at least on the national level. You have the congressional candidates, you have Senate candidates just going out there, just being very, very strong against, for background checks, for the terror watches, and many of them, for an assault weapon ban, whether it's pushing for it now or pushing for it in the future.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a call here. We've got Sandy calling from Kissimmee. Sandy, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning.
Thanks for calling. What are your thoughts on this? What's kind of resonating with you as you think about the election coming up and think about this debate over gun control?
I think Pulse is definitely on my mind. I worked at the Performing Arts Center that sponsored the first of the vigils. I have coworkers who were also working at Pulse and luckily survived. I think that the crackdown on the guns, I own a gun.
Mm-hmm.
I went through the whole process of background checks and waiting period and all of the requisites. So I think that's definitely needed. I think that the crackdowns have to be more on a gun show level, because it's just so accessible. Anybody can just go and buy a gun,
mm-hmm.
and really have no questions asked type of process, as opposed to the process that I went through. I also think that there's a sour taste as far as a lot of the candidates having agendas, because I've been in this community for quite a while. I've been an LGBT supporter for a very long time, over 30 years. I'm a mom, and a lot of my friends are LGBT. And these were the same people that were opposing this community. And I feel like in spite of this community ended up growing exponentially and becoming what it is now, but it wasn't without a lot of opposition from the same people that wanted to kind of cash in on the press that was buzzing around the Pulse tragedy. So, mm-hmm. you know, it's kind of bittersweet. I'm glad that a lot of the people are surviving and making it and coming out of the hospital and being rehabilitated. Huge amount of them were Puerto Rican. Huge amount of them had not come out, and the families found out this way. And I think that what they have to keep in mind, too, as far as the voting goes and trying to capture the Puerto Rican vote, is that, you know, Puerto Rico is bankrupt now because of government corruption. So a lot of the people that are emigrating from the island are kind of gun-shy as far as voting because they don't see that it makes a difference.
Mm-hmm. Sandy, a lot of issues sounds like the Pulse shooting has raised with you, and I do thank you for your call, and you know, glad to hear that your friends are okay. Frank, want to just kind of bring you back to this. I mean, obviously, this is a huge event in Orlando, nationally too. But you know, things move on too. I mean, we heard, of course, we saw that. In the aftermath of Pulse, there were other mass shootings, kind of sucked up national attention, drew attention away from Orlando. I mean, what's your sense of what voters are taking into the booth as they kind of think about some of these issues, you know, looking ahead to November or even in the primary?
You know, Pulse is always going to be very personal to anybody who resided in Orlando during the event. And you're seeing candidates roll it out on their campaign platforms. You see the Pulse logo on campaign mailers. You see other candidates invoking the tragedy when they're slamming their opponents. It's always going to be very personal here. But, you know, to a lawmaker in California or Washington State or South Dakota, you know, they're already numb. You know, it's just another shooting in another town because they lack that personal connection. And I think it's that personal connection and also the increased frequency of these attacks that we're seeing that is always going to, you know, make it a tough issue to really see any change on from a nationwide level. It just doesn't resonate emotionally with people that aren't part of the community like we are here.
Mm-hmm. Tramiel, there were calls within days after the Pulse shooting for a special session in the Florida legislature to close the so-called terror loophole. You know, that call fell on deaf ears. Well, it didn't fall on deaf ears, but it didn't go anywhere. Do you think it will be back in regular session next year, though?
It depends on those who find this issue personal, the lawmakers in Orlando, to really represent their district and bring those issues forward using the Pulse shooting as a backdrop as to a call for change. Outside of that, like even on the national level, here in the state level, it's the further away you go from Orlando, the less people are feeling the strong connection, other than it being another shooting. And in this climate, with the political climate and all of the other things that are pushing into the news cycle and distracting us from these things, it's hard to pinpoint and stay and give the attention that this crisis needs that happened in Orlando.
Well, from Pulse back to the governor of Florida and his war on algae, Scott had tried to get the federal government to declare a state of emergency in counties affected by horrible smelling blue-green algae, which has been seeping out of Lake Okeechobee, clogging the coastal waterways of South Florida. The feds said no to the emergency request. Now Scott is appealing that decision. Frank Torres, just quickly, what's your read on this? Just how badly does Florida need that federal money to help fix this algae mess, or is this just Governor Scott keeping the pressure on for the sake of appearances?
You know, I think it's both. If the federal government and Rick Scott don't get along, they didn't grant, they pulled the low-income pool funding for Medicaid during the session last year. They turned down his emergency request for Pulse. He just has a bad relationship with the federal government, and you know, his political days aren't over. It's very likely he'll run for something else in the future, and there'll be a Republican primary there. And he's also positioning himself as an opponent to the Obama administration. So yeah, while it's frustrating to see these requests for resources get turned down, it's also very political and just a continuation of the tough relationship we've seen between the federal government and Rick Scott.
Mm-hmm. Tramiel Gomes, in the last 30 seconds or so here, what are Governor Scott's options if there isn't more money forthcoming from the federal government, and can Florida afford to fix this mess on its own?
Well, it just needs prioritizing and making this an issue that he can try and tackle on his own. We have issues with water, and then you see the board with most of his appointees that approved increasing carcinogens in our waterways. So it sort of like goes against, we're dealing with this crisis of our water, to go further and allow adding carcinogens in our water body instead of going backwards, like, you know, protecting it. Mm-hmm. So some would point, and environmentalists are pointing to, that he has power to do what he can here before expanding and asking for help elsewhere. So that's what I'm hearing from the folks who are intimately monitoring the issue.
Tramiel Gomes is host of the podcast The Rotunda. Find that online. He joined us from Tallahassee. Thank you so much, Tramiel.
Thanks for having me.
Frank Torres is the editor of the Orlando Political Observer. Thank you so much, Frank.
Thank you so much.
And Steve Limangelo is a political reporter with the Orlando Sentinel. Thank you so much, Steve.
Thank you.
Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. Production assistance for today's show from Nicole Creston and Abe Abariah. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.